for the benefit of those with flash photography.
Yo.
Ooh, yeah, let's do it. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to DreamWork. I, as always, am former WWE ECW star, the extremely cute wrestler Colin Delaney. In a moment, we will be joined by my tag team partner, former Ring of Honor star, the new wave, a man called, that's right, he's Cheech. Together, we are the independent wrestling tag team known as To Infinity and Beyond. And this thing you're listening to? This is DreamWork. Every week on DreamWork, me and Cheech get together and we break down a different tag team in the world of professional wrestling and talk about what made them so great. And in general on here, it's just us talking about how much we love tag team wrestling because tag team wrestling rules. And yeah, this week we have easily one of the greatest tag teams in professional wrestling history. This week we are talking about the Midnight Express. I know there are very many versions of the Midnight Express, but we went with Beautiful Bobby Eaton, Sweet Stan Lane. The Condrey years, Condrey and Eaton, may be some people's favorite. I'm not saying that nobody's favorite is Condrey and Rose, but I'm going to say very few people's favorite rendition of the Midnight Express is Condrey and Randy Rose. But yes, we went with Beautiful Bobby Eaton and Sweet Stan Lane. And this week, I am recording the intro actually before I speak with Cheech. We're a little behind the eight ball, so a little flip-flop this week. So I just got done watching my Midnight Express matches. I am very excited to discuss with Cheech what he thought about them. So let's get right into it. This week, we are talking about Beautiful Bobby Eaton, Sweet Stan Lane, accompanied by Jim Cornette. Yes, 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 it is the Midnight Express. Ding 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 ding.
Bro, I loved it. I was mad when the network would dub over it sometimes.
The weird dub that the WWE Network has is not that fun.
No. I popped every time you could kind of hear it in the background, and I was like, yeah, that's the good stuff.
The Rock and Roll Expresses isn't bad. Their dub is kind of Johnny B. Good.
Eh, I still. The dubs, they hurt my...
Yeah. So anyways, yeah, that'll do it. Midnight Express is the team. I already mentioned that I did record the intro before we spoke to each other. And that was a fun experiment. I totally ended the intro with me doing the exact same thing I just did to start this.
That's okay, because that song just bangs all the time, all right?
It may have to become a new segment on the show where Colin, the theme song of whatever team we discuss.
If they have good themes. Let's be honest. Not everybody's got a banger like the Midnight Express.
Yeah, that's true. If you were like hum Jindrak and O'Hare's theme right now, I'd be like, I don't know what their theme was. And I mean, I imagine it was dubbed on the network, but I couldn't even tell you. I wouldn't even know where to start.
Yeah, exactly. But when you got a classic team like Midnight Express, and here's the thing, like the music was just the cherry on top. You know what I mean? Like some guys, that's the whole thing. Like Ultimate Warrior, the music was a huge chunk. This was literally just the icing on top.
Yeah. Well, okay. Let's get rolling, because I was going to start going into some thoughts, but I'll leave them all out there for when we're discussing the team. Preliminary thoughts about the Midnight Express.
My preliminary thoughts, I go, which ones are we doing? I was like, we're doing Stan Lane and Bobby, right? And you were like, yep. I was like, okay, just making sure. But once we had them picked, I was excited. Oddly, like the first thing that popped into my head was like, ooh, it's going to be colorful.
Yes. My preliminary thoughts, I mean, the Midnight Express, they're the foil to the rock and roll, and everyone knows how great the rock and roll are. So, I mean, I was excited for some classic down south heel wrestling, you know, some heel tag team shtick, if you will.
Yeah, no, it was good stuff. It was good stuff. And that's what I was predicting. And spoiler, guess what? It was still good.
Yes, yes. I was surprised. I was definitely caught off guard by a couple different things, which we will get into. I can't say that this went exactly like I thought it was going to go.
Okay. We can get into it.
But let's get into their tag team accomplishments. Their tag team accomplishments, while not as vast as you might think, very interesting.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They were, especially this tandem was around at a very fun time. So, yeah, I'm sure, and there were a lot of titles running around, so I'm sure, I'm sure it's interesting. Go on.
So they are three-time NWA U.S. Tag Team Champs.
Yep, yep.
They were only NWA World Tag Team Champs one time.
Yeah, I know. It was weird. At that time, I almost feel like the U.S. belts were almost more active than the actual world title. So.
And the only reason I was reading a little bit about it, it seems the only reason they were World Tag Team Champs was to transition when Arn and Tully were headed to WWF at the time.
Yep. Yeah, I know. It's weird when you look back and you were like, oh, I always thought they were champs. And you're like, oh, no, technically they only had it once. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So they are PWI Tag Team of the Year 1987.
Okay. Yep. Yep. That's when they first started going.
They are number 32 on the PWI's top 100 teams of all time.
Rightfully so.
But here's where it gets interesting. The team of Dennis Condrey and Bobby Eaton are number 21 on the top 100.
Yeah, I can see that because I believe they went longer and they were earlier, so they had the benefit of going territory to territory, doing sellouts to sellouts with the rock and roll usually. So yeah, I feel like their footprint's probably a little bigger.
Yeah.
But it was because of the time they were in.
So we just said that they were the PWI Tag Team of the Year for 1987. They were also the Wrestling Observer Tag Team of the Year for 1987 and 1988.
Yeah, I was enjoying all this stuff, 87, 88, 89, 90. Like, yeah, it was all fun.
And here's another interesting one. The Dennis Condrey, Bobby Eaton Midnight Express was the Tag Team of the Year 1986 for The Observer.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's the thing. When I was thinking back, like, I didn't look into it distinctly, but I just remembered. I was like, oh, yeah, it's kind of like Condrey kind of almost just disappeared. It was like, it was Bobby and Dennis were kicking butt and taking names. Like, they never had, like, a downfall. It was just like, oh, one day Dennis was gone, and then suddenly Stan slid right in, like, almost with, like, no hiccup.
Yeah, and from all accounts, Condrey literally just disappeared. He just left. He was like, I'm done, and he just left.
Yeah.
Twice he did this. So anyways, the only other thing, they were also the Wrestling Observer Feud of the Year 1988. Can you guess which team they were Feud of the Year with?
Okay, if it was 88, it wouldn't have been the dudes. Rock and Roll. Oh, no, the Fantastics,
right? Fantastics.
Yeah. Oh, brother. Whew, wait till we get to talking about their matches.
yeah. So those are the that's the accomplishments of the Midnight Express. Like I said, they're not as lengthy as I thought they would be. The interesting part for me is the fact that, like we were just saying, the Condrey run, which was epic and thought of as better than the Eaton and Lane run, basically runs right into Lane and Eaton.
Yeah. And the thing I find interesting is their, what do they call them? Like super bands? They're a super team because you've got Eaton, who's still the original member from the Midnights, and then you got Stan, who was part of the Fabulous Ones, who was also a good tag wrestler in his own right.
Yeah.
Does this sound kind of familiar?
I totally forgot that Stan was one of the fabulous ones until I was doing a little more research, because I was like, what happened to Stan Lane? And then I was like, oh, yeah, he did go to Smoky Mountain. He was the original Heavenly Bodies. And then he did do that weird analyst run with WWF.
Yep. And then he went into, like, because he's got a great voice. Didn't he go into, like, radio and stuff? Wasn't he, like, I think he got, like, a NASCAR announcing or something like that.
That sounds awesome. I don't know that to be true, but I love every part of it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I believe, at least last time I saw him, like, he... which was a few years ago, but he almost looks just as good, if not better, because now he's got, like, short hair and modern looking, and it was just like, damn, Stan's just one of those guys that's just, you know what I mean, got in the business, out the business, seems to be okay, seems to still just be the man, and, like, doesn't seem broken down, still looks good, like, God bless.
Well, his run, just in wrestling in general, I think his run start to finish, we've both been wrestling longer than Stan Lane was around, period.
I know, and I'll say it. He's a little rough around the edges in spots, but God, do I love him. I want more Stan Lane in me. Like, yeah. He's so flashy, but, like, there are a couple – here's the good thing about him. His rough spots were hidden. Like, very rarely did I ever see him go, oh. But, like, you knew it was kind of almost always there.
Yeah, but when you think about it, he probably started in what, like, early to mid-80s, and he was out by 94, 95. Like, his run was, like, 12, 13 years long.
Yeah, he's one of those guys that got in, got out, and is, once again, just still lives a normal life. It was just a part of his life. It wasn't, like, his whole life, obviously.
Right, yeah. All right, I'm interested as to what way you took this with matches that you watch, because I feel like I went a very specific direction. So let's hear it. What matches did you watch?
Okay. Well, normally what I like to do is I like to start and see what I can get on YouTube, because that one is just – it's a little easier to navigate than the network. And then eventually I work up to the network and watch, like, pay-per-view stuff on there, because you can't get that on YouTube. So, like, early on I was watching, like, TV stuff, but I liked that it was – I would watch their TV match and then eventually kind of watch their pay-per-view match in certain cases. So that was cool. So, like, but the first one I started off with was a versus Rock and Roll on a main event from April 90, a Southern Boys from a Saturday night in 90, Brian Pillman and Z-Man, Road Warriors, Fantastics, another Rock and Roll, a Nikita and Barry, a Samoan SWAT team, Dynamic Dudes, Ryan Wagner and Scott Atkinson, just because we know a guy named Ryan Wagner, so I thought it was funny. Ron and Jimmy Garvin, Road Warriors, Eddie Gilbert and Tommy Rich, the original Midnights when they had that thing going, another Southern Boys, a Cruel Connection, just because I had to see who the Cruel Connection was, a Flair and Wyndham, a Fantastics, Squash versus Mike Jackson, who's great, and Agent Steel, who I just had to see who that was. And I think it was Chris Champion under a hood. I could be wrong. then another... Ryan Pillman and Z-Man, and then ended on a Havoc 90, Thomas Rich and Ricky Morton as, like, greasers. And that was hella fun.
Interesting. Yeah, I started – so I always go chronologically. And I stopped at the Z-Man and Pillman because that's, like – that's getting down to the end. So I started off – their first match on a TV as a team, just the two of them, is against Larry Stevens and Tommy Angel. I watched them against the Rock and Roll. I watched them against Wyndham and Garvin. I watched them against Barry and Kendall Wyndham. I watched them against the Fantastics, them against the Fantastics, them against Wyndham and Flair, them against the OG Midnight Express, them against the Dynamic Dudes, them against the Rock and Roll Express, them against the Rock and Roll Express. So I started with the match with Larry Stevens and Tommy Angel. And then after that, I really went for, like, them working with dudes, you know, people who, like, had name recognition. Because there are so many matches where they just wrestle jobbers.
Yes, definitely. That's why I tried to keep it to, like, TV matches versus name teams that I knew they eventually, like, I knew watching the Southern Boys, I was like, oh, I know they have a pay-per-view match with them. I knew with the Pillman and Z-Man, and I go, oh, I know they have, like, there's, like, a blow-off or, like, a big match, and it's usually the pay-per-view and stuff.
Yeah, so first of all, this has definitely been the most difficult search for matches one we've done, because you cannot type in Midnight Express into the search bar of the WWE Network, because you will get a lot of Dennis Condrey and Bobby Eaton.
Yeah, no, I did that, but then, yeah, I just had to go through and just cherry pick. And then basically I was just able to, then I knew the years. I was like, okay, wait, no, if it's 86 and before, it's Condrey. If it's 87 and after, it's Lane. So I just kept an eye on that.
I got so excited a couple of different times going, ooh, this one looks fun. Like Midnight Express Sheep Herders. I was like, oh, I'll watch the crap out of this. And I'm like, Condrey!
Ah! Yeah, I know. And listen, those have its merit. We may have to jump into them eventually, too, because they were just as good. But with this, like I said, I was thinking, I thought Stan Lane, I'm thinking it's late 80s, 90, it's going to be colorful, and there's a millions of guys, you know what I mean? Like you said, they wrestled tons of TV matches, but I'm just saying, like, if you look at the names, it was like, yeah, they were repeats, but it was like the Samoans, you've got Road Warriors, you've got Nikita randomly, you got the Garvins together, and which I always find odd, because I was like, really? Whatever, I know they're related in some way, it's just odd to me. But like, yeah, and even they got in there with Flair and stuff, like, it was great.
So, off the rip, watching them against... Oh, first of all, I wanted to make this observation because, you know, I go through the cage match. By the way, in the 3 years or so they were together, there's like 7 pages worth of cage matches. Those guys literally wrestled every day.
Oh, and with the amount of work that Bobby was doing, like, Bobby Eaton's probably had 9 bajillion matches. Like, his body's just... God bless them with a body made for wrestling. Because, yeah, like, obviously, they were working a ton, and you could tell, like, and, like, damn, they were just so seasoned, you know what I mean? It made sense that they were wrestling a bunch.
Yeah, so when looking through the cage match, you know, they got a little thing noting if it's a TV match, so if I can look it up. Man, there's so many matches that are just, like, dark matches that'll never see the light of day, or just, like, live matches that sound fucking incredible that I was like, oh, why can't I watch this?
Oh, I was happy I was able to see some of the Great American, like, I think one or two of them was the Bash tours where it wasn't a TV or anything, it was just a live event, but it was recorded, so I was able to watch it. I was like, oh, those some of those are just badass too.
So in the entirety of the Midnight Express Stan Lane Bobby Eaton run, take a stab at how many times on TV or pay-per-view they wrestled the Rock and Roll Express.
Okay, can we go percentage? I'm thinking between 30 and 40.
I'm talking, yeah, so like TV, like clearly like on live events and stuff, when you look at just results, they wrestled them like every other night.
Okay, so was it how close was it to 50-50?
As far as TV and pay-per-view matches go, they literally only wrestled the Rock and Roll Express 8 times.
Uh-huh, but...
Well, right, they wrestled them a bajillion times in general. But when you think of the Midnight Express, you think of the Rock and Roll, and you just think they have a million matches that if you just, like, with a, you know, swipe of your mouse, you can find. But as far as TV and pay-per-view in general, together, combined, 8!
Yeah, because, well... Wouldn't their heyday of having a ton of stuff like that would have been a little bit earlier in the Condrey era?
It would have been, but I in my brain, that stat blew me away.
Well, because, like, look at it. Like I said, the last match I saw, there was a while there where it was Ricky Morton on his own. I think Robert really got hurt or something. So, you know what I mean? Like, they obviously lost time there to wrestle them a bunch. And plus, I think by the time they were in WCW in 88, 89, 90, like, Midnights versus the Rock and Roll had already happened. It was a good glove you could always put on, and it always worked and always great, you know what I mean? But I could also see them trying to get away from it since they wrote it so hard in the earlier part of the 80s.
Well, also, the Midnight Express had that weird babyface run where they wrestled Flair and Wyndham, and when they feuded with the original Midnight Express.
Did you enjoy it?
And the Simone, no, I hate
Whoa!
It.
See, I kind of enjoyed it but I think I only enjoyed it because I had seen so much of them as bad guys. You know what I mean?
I watched the Flair and Wyndham, and I was like, oh, this is weird seeing them as baby faces. But it makes sense because, you know, Flair and Wyndham were like the big heels. So they were just like not as heel as them. And then I watched them against the original Midnight Express, and I was like, I can't, I don't think I can do this. And I saw the Samoan SWAT team matches, and I was like, man, I do love Samoan SWAT team, but I don't think I can watch another match where they're baby faces.
Oh, brother, you would have loved it because, like Stan Lane is giving them hip tosses and body, like, they were taking big bumps for the little Midnight Express compared to, it was Samu and Fatu. And I was just like,
oh, yeah.
Like, obviously they weren't their biggest, but they were, like, for TV, they're big guys, and they were just feeding right in for body slams and hip tosses. I was just like, wow, they are taking big bumps for little guys.
So you may know this. I don't really have a recollection of it, but they put it over like it was a thing that the Midnight Express did in that first match where they're together. They keep doing a spot where whoever's in the ring goes to pitch the opponent to the floor, and the partner would act like they were going to catch and then move out of the way at the last second.
Oh, no.
Is that a Midnight Express spot? Was that a Condry and Eaton spot?
Maybe. I don't know. There was some. Here's the thing. After watching all these matches in their time, there's some weird stuff thrown out every now and then.
Like, Stan Lane would grab the guy and act like he's going to pitch him to the, and he would, like, get ready to pitch him to the floor. Bobby Eaton would stand on the outside with his arms out like he was going to catch him, and then he would just move out of the way, and Stan Lane would just pitch the dude to the floor. And they did it, like, three different times. The announcer's like, classic Midnight Express spot. And I was like, is that? That's a thing they used to do often?
Probably. And it's weird to call it classic if it was the first time he was doing it with Stan.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I thought it was weird, but I wasn't mad at it.
But, okay, after watching their matches, they do a lot of shenanigans on the outside.
Yes. Yes, they do. They spend a lot of time on the outside.
But, okay, here's what I noticed from watching all their matches. To be a little primitive, it's kind of like they're going to get beat up in the beginning, and then what I think makes their matches so good is their middles are real good. Whereas a lot of guys, a lot of matches kind of lose you in the middle. They've got so many tricks, and then they've got corny on the outside. They've got the ref that they play like a fiddle. So, like, it was just good stuff. And, like, the ability – and then, of course, they always have an action-packed ending, so the crowd always goes home happy. Like, it's just a real good formula to always have the crowd up, up, up. You know what I mean?
So, and in watching these matches, that is why the Rock and Roll were the perfect foil, because the Rock and Roll, what the Midnight Express needed was somebody with a good beginning. They needed a team that could rock and roll, pun completely intended, in the beginning. So then when they got to their middle, you know, the crowd was ready for it, but they didn't always get that.
No, definitely not. That's what I noticed. Like, their better matches were when they were with good baby faces, like there was a, and it was always, yeah, whoever had a really good action-packed open, like Z-Man and Fiend Brian did. I saw the last one I saw with Bobby and Ricky Morton went in, and they did an open, and they went ham, dude. They went bonkers. It was great. There was pass-bys, ducks, then there was the crisscross spot to a drop-down to baseball slides to, like, drop kicks. And flawless, because it was 1990, so they'd probably done this a million times, but it was just great because you're like, oh, it's pay-per-view, they really want to show out, and it was awesome. But that's what I'm saying, that's why in watching that I was like, oh, no wonder Rock and Roll were perfect for them. They were there step in step doing Japanese head scissors. Did you hear that one?
Oh yeah,
yeah. Ricky Morton was hitting his Japanese head scissors left and right on Bobby, and I was like, damn, Bobby's a good base for the day.
Oh, I was going to mention that. I just praise Bobby Eaton in almost every match. I just sneak some kind of Bobby Eaton compliments in because, man, he was incredible. I wrote in one match, he's such an all-purpose talent. I wrote in another match, what a great bass. Regularly was like, man, Bobby Eaton.
Did you notice that Bobby Eaton regularly took not one, but two shines?
Yes. Oh, yeah, for sure.
Like, literally, he was in there for the first 5 minutes before Stan ever got, like, all right, let me go in there now.
Well, do you think that's also because Stan Lane had a pretty rotten bump for the most part?
But he was not a – that was the thing. I don't know why. In my head when I thought Stan Lane, I think, okay, pretty boy. I go, okay, Bobby's going to do all the work and he's just going to be afraid. I go, he was a great chicken shit. Yeah, he wasn't the best, but I thought he'd be like afraid to bump. Hell no. He was in there taking bumps too. He took his licks.
He took bumps, but they were like real awkward and sideways and sometimes floaty. He was a great chicken shit. And I'm just saying like bumping was not his strong suit.
Yeah, I know. I'm wondering, sometimes I was trying to, like, I could tell, and I wonder if that's from, like, his karate background.
Yeah, that's possible. Most of my things that I wrote about Bobby Eaton are complimentary about his work. Most of the things I wrote about Stan Lane have something to do with his appearance.
But yeah, man, he was the Flash, bro. He brought all the pizzazz. I loved it when he would hit those crazy hip swivels from 1980 and the crowd would either go bonkers or hate him over it, depending on what they were. Which I thought, come on, crowd. If you hated him when he was a bad guy swiveling his hips, oh, now he's sort of a good guy and you're like, oh, suddenly you just love it. I was like, ah, I was just disappointed in people. But I love the antics, but it was just like, oh, one week he's a bad guy, boo. Oh, he's a good guy, yay. I was like, he did the same thing.
I wrote pretty early, Stan Lane looks like a mini older Lex Luger.
Yeah, he was great. And he had the look, like he was big enough. I liked it when he would do, every time he'd get in, he'd do that stupid leg stretch. I was like, oh, so he just seemed like, he seemed almost like a cheesy bad guy from a movie. You know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah. Especially when he got the mustache.
In the best way, I mean, you know what I mean? Like, I loved him. So none of these are negatives. But yeah, he definitely just seemed like a, sometimes a little mustache twirly and was just like the pretty boy bad guy.
Yeah. No, you're not wrong. We'll get into his kicks in a little bit.
How they're amazing.
Because, whoo-wee. I also wrote kind of early, especially for these like studio tapings.
Uh-huh.
Do you think that the crowd made some of the more boring parts of the match sound more exciting?
Yeah, because I don't think it was boring to people in 1988.
Man, Ronnie Garvin tried to fight out of a headlock for like 4 straight minutes, and I was like, just I'm over him trying to fight out of this headlock, and the crowd is going bananas. And David Crockett loses his mind over things.
Yeah, that's what he did. He was Marky Mark back in the day.
I was pretty sad when I got to the point where I didn't have David Crockett announcing anymore. You know, I love me some Jim Ross and Tony Schiavone, but man, David Crockett going ham on commentary for everything was awesome.
Yeah, and that's the thing, like if you were someone who wanted a reason to be mad at these guys, they always gave you it. They were always, the ref had his back turned, they're throwing him over the top rope, how dare you, that's freaking illegal, and the ref's not looking, they're gonna whack him with a racket. Like, they had so many good things to keep you on the line being mad and angry.
And I noticed back then you almost didn't notice the ref at all. So it wasn't as egregious when he got his back turned. Does that make sense?
Yeah. You could tell how important refs were when you watch these matches where it's important that he's not looking.
But you, like, before the spot and even while the spot's going on, I almost didn't even notice that they didn't, like, do, like, big, elaborate, like, oh, come look over here, ref. Let me hop around so you can come get distracted. He just, like, pretty under the radar got distracted long enough for them to do some shit.
Yeah, they didn't make a big deal about it. It wasn't like, you know, TV today where it's like, oh, Cornette's gonna distract the ref, let's go over there and zoom in on it. It was just like, no, they stayed on the hard cam. You just saw in the corner the ref walked over and was like, hey, what's going on? And then, oh, his back's turned.
Yeah, I liked it a lot, honestly. I was like, man, I wish that things could be like that now. I don't like the overly dramatic, it has to be this big production to distract him. Honestly, he's just trying to enforce the rules.
Exactly, and they always know, and I think, I don't know if it's a trope or it's just an automatic go-to that, like, oh, if you need the ref distracted, then, like, the illegal guy in the apron gets in and the ref knows automatically to just go, which opens the lane to do whatever you want, you know what I mean? Like, it didn't need to be elaborate, it just needed to, he literally just, someone needed to break the rules and the ref was going to go attend to it.
Yeah. Yeah, you're not wrong. So I wrote this the first thing I wrote watching the first Fantastics match. The Fantastics are a poor man's Rock and Roll Express.
Yes, but do you find yourself the more and more you see them, the more and more you're like, they're not the poor man's Rock and Roll. They're not the poor man's anything.
Yeah, correct. But right off the rip, that's the first thing I think, because they're like trying to do very similar things that the Rock and Roll Express would do to like open a match, just not as good.
Here's the problem. They were the second. They always followed the Rock and Roll wherever they went. So it seemed like they were always just trying to out rock and roll the Rock and Roll by, you know, fast opens, ping pong, and, you know, all these big moves that were, you know, big for the day. So it just seemed like they were just trying, you know, I mean, they were trying to outgun the Rock and Roll, but the Rock and Roll were just so ingrained in everyone that it was just like any fiery babyface team that came up in their wake was going to be automatically compared, especially them when they were literally the next team up usually.
Yeah. So Bobby Fulton's good. Tommy Rogers looked good and was real, real good.
Of course. Hell yeah, bro.
Man. I did an indie show down in Tennessee with Bobby Fulton.
Yeah, I know. I was right. He still wrestles.
He's still at it. Yeah. Oh yeah. I don't know what Tommy Rogers is doing. I meant to look it up, but because we're not doing the Fantastics, I forgot.
But yeah, he was awesome. What was fun? Okay. Did you see the pay-per-view one they had?
I think so. I didn't write next to the, Bash 88.
The one where they're using tables and chairs.
No.
Oh, wait, which one was it? Let me find it. Oh, where is it? Oh, okay. Clash number one.
Oh, Clash one. I missed that one. I watched a TV match of theirs and Great American Bash 88.
Okay, maybe I'll need to see. I don't know. But Clash one, you need to see. Because literally, they start out brawling. Literally, I wrote in my notes, I go, I watched it, and 2 seconds in, I go, oh, somebody was watching ECW. And then I was like, oh, wait, this is like 5 years before ECW.
yeah, 88.
Yeah, I'm not even kidding. Literally, like, they brawl right from the beginning to the outside. They're using chairs liberally at the beginning, and then during the match they still use them, but behind the ref's back. But like, they're throwing tables at each other, they're brawling on the floor, and here's the best part, it's Clash one. So I was like, oh, I had to look it up. At first I was like, oh, I bet you this is better than whatever's on Survivor Series right now. It wasn't. It was Survivor Series was running. They ran Survivor Series to run a post to Starrcade. So to get them back, they ran Clash 1 when WrestleMania 4 was going on. So I looked it up and did the timing, or roughly. This match was around, the second match, so it was around 24 minutes into the show. 20 to a half hour was their spot, give or take. I was like, on WrestleMania 4, it was the opening round. So like the closest thing it had to compete with was like a 6 minute Steamboat versus Valentine match. So I was just like, this match, like if you could flip the channels back then, I was like, oh, you're totally watching this tag match over whatever garbage, not even garbage, but it's garbage compared to this tag match that they, because I think it was, there was like a, they were just, you know, those weird wonky first round matches that were all like 4 and 5 minutes at WrestleMania 4. I was like, this match is blowing away all of that.
I love that you went back and lined them up like you're literally Wednesday Night Wars, Monday Night Wars.
Yep, that's exactly what I said. I was like, the purpose of them having the clash that day is like, oh, we'll run something free on TV so you don't pay to see WrestleMania. And I was just like, oh. And they brought out the guns because that was the one where the main event is Sting and Flair go 45 minutes. So if this match, I bet you this was probably the second best match on the show then. You know what I mean? But the match was bonkers. They're using tables. It's just crazy. Yeah, you should definitely go. Everybody go see it.
Going through some of those old events, like old clashes and some of those old pay-per-views, there's like random undercard matches that I have no recollection of, but if I was just scrolling through looking for something to watch, I'd be like, oh, I'm watching this right now.
What I loved about watching this was this was roughly the years that, well, first it was Captain Video, well, first it was Video Ranger, then it was Captain Video, and it was the only place I could get WCW tapes. So like I remember going and getting all of 89 and 90, so like Capital Combat, Future Shock, Halloween Havoc 90, like all these things. I was like, oh, I've seen these when I was 10 and 11 or however old I was, because you'd go to the video rental store. It's hard to remember because they're antiquated now, but it would always be, you know, you get a new rental and then you get one of whatever else is in the building. And it would always be, I'd go right to the wrestling section. And they had the whole line of like 89 and 90 WCW pay-per-views.
Yeah, my Blockbuster had like, they didn't have stuff that old. I think they had some like old WWF stuff, but their WCW stuff started in like 94, 95. But I used to watch it all the time.
Yeah, I remember being pumped because it was just a whole new world to me because I don't think we got TBS until around 92, 93. So that was the only way I was able to see anything WCW before. And, oh, man, it was just so great. It brought back so many memories. I was like, oh, I remember the pay-per-view where it was four singles guys in a round-robin tournament and four tag teams in a round-robin tournament and all that. Oh, it was just great.
So I wrote this one early, and it definitely needs its own section of this podcast. Bobby Eaton's leg drop was really, really nasty.
Whoa, Bobby Eaton. Let's just talk about it. Let's just get to it. Okay, I think I give no argument that he was maybe the best worker in the business at that time. You agree or no?
Oh, yeah, no. He's a Swiss Army knife. He's so versatile. He can do whatever. They called him a high flyer. He was like this in no shape dude with a mullet, and he was the high flyer of the team.
I know. Okay, because that was okay. I do agree that for everything you said, but I think the thing that really just tops him off is he was also able to do top rope moves. You know what I mean? If you take that away, you're like, all right, he's a good worker, and he's a hell of a good worker. But like that, the fact that, yeah, he was the high flyer, just totally, like, you couldn't take your eyes off him.
And he wasn't like just throwing like bootleg stuff off the top. If he came off the top, that leg drop was hitting, and it was hitting good.
Okay, you love to, you know, bounce and pop right to your feet. Did you see how many times he hit that leg drop and just pop right to his feet?
Oh, yeah. And then, like, sometimes he'd throw an elbow drop, and I'm like, man, that's such a clean, nice-looking elbow drop. Or a top rope knee drop. I was like, man, look at them. Everything he does off the top is, like, it's so natural for him.
And looks killer. You know what I mean? Like, those elbow drops, yeah, they were pretty, but I looked at him, I was like, woo, that looks rough.
Those leg drops, I know that at a point it was like his finish and his thing, but the fact that guys were kicking out of it in this day was pissing me off because it looks disgusting.
Okay, thank you. Towards the end, I was getting mad at them bastardizing moves. Like the Z-Man and Pillman pay-per-view match, he kicks out of Alabama Jam, clean as a whistle, kicks out a rocket launcher, clean as a whistle. I was like, what are these guys doing?
Yeah, I mean, early Midnight Express, I think that Larry Stevens-Tommy Angel match, I think the finish was just a Stan Lane thrust kick.
I was going to say, I also think the thing that worked in their favor was they used everything as a finish, so, like, it always worked in their favor that anything could be a finish, because I think I saw them use Vegematic, I think I saw once. They did a double flapjack. They did the high-low, or they had some other name for it, but like they just had a bunch of different things that they could use. So anytime someone did something, you were like, this could be the finish. Like it was plausible at all times.
Yeah. While I was watching them the first time when I watched Flair and Wyndham was the first time I saw them as faces. And I was like, oh, this is kind of weird. But I was like, oh, you know what? Eaton still looks good because he's so all purpose. But that's where I really start to take a good look at Stan Lane's kicks.
Okay, go on.
So when they are good, they are great. And for the time, they're unbelievable.
Yep, keep going.
But when they are bad, they're awful. But still unbelievable for their time.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like his soul butt, you know, the indie kick, you know, the spinning back kick to the gut. Those were always rough. But like, I also found funny that, you know, he's this big karate man, but like no kick ever went above like the belly button.
Correct. And what would really irritate me is he would throw that kick and sometimes guys would like sell the face, which would make me go, was he supposed to hit the face? And that was just where his karate kick went.
Yeah, the only time it went high was when he would do like an enziguri, But, like, other than that, it was just a whole lot of his kicks just went, you know, like leg kicks and like body kicks. But, like, you were never going to see him throw like a roundhouse to the head.
Right. No, you weren't. But again, here's the thing. I had to keep reminding myself.
Yeah, go on.
For the time they were like, nobody was doing like karate kicks like that and effectively and often.
See, what I think helped was, like, obviously you could tell he really did do karate, because when he was doing all the poses and posturing, it looked legit as fuck. So then it was just weird, because he'd be like, he'd do all the movements and he'd look, you'd be like, oh, this dude's a badass. And then he'd get like a spinning back kick and he'd be like, oh, okay. You know, but all the in between flash and pizzazz parts he had covered.
I also wrote down when they were, because then I start, I got into another match where they're babyface, and I was like, oh, I can't do more of this. So the one thing I wrote, Bobby Eaton doesn't look like a dude you'd want to cheer.
True. But I don't know, maybe you're in the hair. If you're in a mullet, he's your man, though.
I
don't know. It looked majestic. And, you know, it flowed nicely as he would come off the top rope. So, you know, you could cheer for him and his hair.
I chose not to.
You're cheering for the cool moves. You know what I mean? Because, once again, he was a great wrestler and then also did cool moves.
Yeah, so I was excited when they turned back heel on the Dynamic Dudes. And if there's one thing I took away from that match, the Dynamic Dudes had dope gear, and I want those trunks.
Okay, the trunks, but I did not like the tearaway bathing suits. I was like, okay, come on. That's a little too white meat baby face, you know, bordering on gigolo.
Also, I love how Johnny Ace looks 40 with a blonde mullet, even though he probably was like 23.
I just don't understand why he's like, I didn't understand it for the day. Like, kind of same thing. Okay, what's his name? Tommy Gunn or Brandy, when he would do it. Like, what's with these dudes who are like 6'4 and 6'5 being like, I'm going to do arm drags and hip tosses, baby. It was like, you're not a little guy. Like, you're not cruiserweights. I know that wasn't a term in the day, but like, it seems like that's what they're going for. I was like, why? Because you're slightly skinny, but you're still 6'5. What are you doing? Like, oh, I do hip tosses and drop kicks. I was like, why?
Yeah, Johnny Ace is a gigantic man, but my man definitely has 40 face, even when he was young.
Yeah, I know, but like, I don't know, it just irked me watching him, and there were a couple, I don't know, when we watch matches from this time frame, I'm just like, why? I get that, like, okay, you're a baby face, but it doesn't mean you have to wrestle the, you know, like you're a Rock and Roll Express guy, of, you know, hip toss, arm drag, drop kicks, come on, baby, you know what I mean?
Yeah, but if you were a white meat babyface tag team at the time, you did, right?
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. It just seems odd. Like, okay, it works for the Rock and Roll because they're smaller guys, usually against bigger guys, so they got to be fast and do a bunch of stuff. But when you're 6'4", you don't need to be fast. You're like, oh, I can just reach and grab you. I don't have to run after you.
Yeah, that's true. Did you feel like down towards the end, when we're talking about like them against Z-Man and Pillman, do you feel like Z-Man and Pillman's pace was a little too fast?
A little bit. Well, that's where I feel like, okay, I feel like that's a clash of like 80, like the Midnights were a fast-paced 80s team, and now they're facing a fast-paced 90s team, is kind of what I felt like when I saw.
Exactly.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, but it was weird for me because I was like, this is the Midnight's game. They do this all the time and they're great at it. But Pillman and Z-Man, I think, are just a little too quick on the draw here, a little too quick on the trigger.
Yeah, I think they were young and fiery, so it got a little wonky because they were just, you know what I mean? They just had so much energy that they didn't know where to put it. So it just, you know what I mean? Because it seemed like, obviously, they had a rapport. Or at least most guys, when they got in there with the Midnights, were like, oh, let's go. These guys go. We can go. Let's go. So but when you had, you know, a fresh, young, baby-faced Brian Pillman going balls to the wall, that's tough to keep up with.
Yeah, that's true. I just noted it. I was like, oh, man. It feels like, not that the Midnights are a step behind, but like the Z-Man and Pillman are like a step too quick You know, you can only go as fast as the slowest guy. And I felt like they were like a step too quick for what was going on in there.
Well, I don't know if you know this, but if you didn't, JR will let you know that Brian Pillman, you know, he was that wedge gapper, bro. He was on the Suicide Squad. He got the blah, blah, blah inspirational award, and all his friends that went on to do great stuff still remember him because he's courageous. Look at this young, courageous Pillman. I was like, we get it, JR. Relax.
Yeah, so then in 1990, because I was looking into the Wikipedia, apparently they showed up to TV and they just weren't booked. And then they showed up to TV and they were on the schedule to lose four matches. And Cornette blew up on whoever was running stuff at the time. And Lane and Cornette just bounced. Like, yep. Ole Anderson went to go look for them to go have their matches and they were gone.
Yep, and then poor Bobby played, you know, Bobby's the good guy, so he stayed and he was the company man and things still worked out for him. But yeah. Dude, I think Cornette has like a shooter, one of those timelines from that year, and he goes into all of it. So I've heard all the rigmarole and all this stuff about the Midnight, the original Midnights versus his Midnights and that whole feud. But yeah, he thought, and rightfully so, like, it was one of those things where I could see Cornette's opinion going, look, we're over, the crowd's loving us. But I could also see, you know, like the bookers being like, all right, it's the 90s now. We're going to move on, kind of. Yeah, I know it's a new team, but like you still heard the name Midnight Express for almost two decades at that point or something. You know what I mean? So I feel like I understand that they wanted to move on, but I could also see Cornette's opinion of being like, we're over as heck. Everyone loves us. We're making everyone look great. You know what I mean? Because think about it. In those years, they were like, that was when they were working with Pillman and they were working with Flair and Wyndham and Joe Schmo on TV. So like they could do everything. Yeah. So I could see both sides.
Sure. I suppose I can too. I don't know if it's warrants walking out like the two of them did, but that, I guess, conversation for another day. And when we get to the Heavenly Bodies, it leaves the do we do Stan Lane and Dr. Tom, or do we go straight to Gigolo Jimmy?
I don't know. See, that's the problem. I love Stan Lane in Midnights, but I also love Gigolo Jimmy.
Agreed. That's a conversation for another day.
Okay. But here's a conversation right. Here's one I wanted to have. Now, as a man who's just watched roughly 20 or so Midnight Express matches, the big freaking argument that I hear that I find a little misguided, and let's have it. Cornette thinks the Midnight Express and the Young Bucks have zero in common. I disagree.
Okay. I said this to you yesterday, but I really don't think there's that much different between then and now. I think you could hate on different things then. There are things that are better now, and there are things that are better then, but neither are perfect.
True, but like I feel like I've heard Cornette kind of put out this argument that like, no, the Midnights weren't just throwing away and doing needlessly big moves for blah, blah, blah sake. And I was like, I don't know, man. Like Bobby Eaton's like spitting neck breaker was a big deal in 1987-88. So like the modern equivalent of that might be, you know, Nick Jackson's 450. You know what I mean?
Yes, no, for sure. And as far as like big moves, back then, the Midnights were doing them. Bobby Eaton was coming off the top rope with that leg drop. And like you just said, Brian Pillman kicked out clean as a whistle of that thing.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, they were also using fancy moves. Sure, when you look back, you're like, oh, it's a drop toe hold, and then the other one drops an elbow. I go, but like, that's the equivalent of like the Young Bucks with that thing where you give you the backbreaker, and then the other one does the neck breaker and the backbreaker. Like, that's just it modernized. Like, I think that. Yeah, the Young Bucks are kind of the modern equivalent, or the Midnight Express were just as outlandish and athletic as the Bucks are now. So I think like Cornette's argument of like, no, the Midnight were so much different and better. I was like, I don't think so.
No, I agree with you. That's the thing about eras. That's the same for any sport, man. You just can't compare and argue eras unless you're willing to like talk about the merits of both and how and why they're different and compare them for like what they are, like we just did about, like, man, Bobby Eaton's leg drop was one of the biggest, nastiest moves you were seeing in 87, and guys were kicking out of that bird.
Exactly. You know what I mean? You got to be able to, like, yeah, you can, everything is fine. You just got to be able to be like, all right, like, same thing with, like the dollar. Like, all right, a dollar in 1950 is not what a dollar is in 2020. Same thing, whereas, like, a spinning neck breaker in 1986 and what it would be equivalent to now would be something big. You know what I mean? So I think it's an apt comparison, whereas I feel like, you know what I mean? Like, obviously, Cornette's close to it. He was their manager. But I'm just saying, as a man who just watched 20 matches in 3 days, I think the comparison is a good comparison. I disagree with him in that.
Yeah. I do not argue with you at all. I watched Bobby Eaton do a back suplex, a slingshot back suplex backbreaker, which I was like, that's disgusting, A. B, I don't think I've ever seen that again. Like, that's a big old move.
And that whole thing, I feel like that's a Bobby thing. I've never seen anybody do the same one. He just grabs you from under the armpits and just puts you in a backbreaker. Like, nobody did that. And then I like that it evolved. He had the normal one, and then he had the springboard into it, I guess you would say.
Nasty.
Yeah.
Nasty offense.
But same thing. Like, okay, that move, highly creative, highly effective, and was just a move in the middle of the match in 1988.
Sure was. And I have no idea. It blew my mind. I was like, oh, that's disgusting. Who's kicking out of that thing?
No, but yeah, that was just the Bobby thing. He throw it in there all the time. And yeah, that's the thing. Like, once again, what made his matches enjoyable is because anything could be a finish because he just had cool stuff and it usually won matches. That's the good thing about all those matches with the jobbers where it's like, I don't know, he won 3 matches in a row with the leg drop off the top. Oh, crap, Pillman kicks out. That's a big deal.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's one thing about old wrestling that it's tough to replicate now. We're kind of out of that era.
Yeah, it's tough to get a bunch of wins with, like, throwaway moves so that you could have them for later on. You know what I mean?
Not to pull it back too far, but one time WWE would not let me lose to a side effect. So.
Oh, that sucks. That's stupid.
What? I was like the little get beat up, get crushed in 2 minutes guy, and they wouldn't even let me lose to Matt Hardy's side move.
You're so strong, you need a finisher, all right, Colin?
Yeah, I did. That's true. You're not wrong. All right, so we're approaching 50 minutes on this thing, so we better hustle.
Well, it's worth it. They had such good stuff. And we didn't even talk about it. Side tangent, only for a second, while we're talking bad karate. Stans may have been, you know, iffy, but God, I loved it when him and Tracy would knuckle up and go, oh, let's do this. That was always a high spot in all the Southern Boy matches. I just had to give that its love. Yep.
I didn't get into any of the Southern Boys matches, and I'm kind of pissed at myself for that. I was going chronologically, like I said, so by the time they got to the Southern Boys, it's going to be late, and I was already at my quota.
So you need to see it. What I liked is I caught also the matches that, like, led up to it. Like, I watched them versus, like, Pillman and Z-Man or something, and then the Southern Boys come out, like, dressed up as Cornette to distract and blah, 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 and all this stuff. Oh, no, wait, that was the Rich and Morton match. But still, like, they just had – like, it was – they had a feud. Like, there was, they would interfere in each other's matches, yada, yada, yada. And then they got to their big blow off at, I don't even know if it was the blow off, but, like, they had a pay-per-view match. And what was great about then was, like, when you think Southern Boys, you don't think of one, like, specific classic, but, like, guys like that didn't get pay-per-view matches all that often. So their pay-per-view match was bonkers. Cause it was like, you could tell they were like, it's our time to show out. And the Midnights were always perfect.
Yeah.
Cause they would just take. So it was perfect.
And back then, they didn't really have – they had, what, 3-4 pay-per-views a year and a couple clashes?
Yeah, but you know what I mean? Like, it was the first time where you see them in the Southern Boys where it's like, oh, it's not just, like, one heat or one comeback or one false. There were multiples of each. So it was like, oh, this is so cool because it's pay-per-view. They're ready to go.
Right, for sure. All right. So what made this incarnation, Stan Lane and Bobby Eaton, the Midnight Express, so great?
I say it was they were masters of controlling a match. Like, I wrote, they were, one of my notes was like, they're human metronomes where, like, they can read the pace of the crowd and when it's time to bring it up, when it's time to bring it down. Like, they were especially Bobby. especially. But Stan was always the icing on the cake. But like that's what I meant. Like their middle of the matches were so good because they were so good at control, and they were always good despite being bad guys. Whenever they had a chance, they showed their athleticism. So it just made what they were doing even more and raised the stakes for the matches usually.
So I think a part of it, and I'm not sure, I'd have to put more brain power behind it, but I'm not sure there's ever been an example of a team that was literally the tag team of the year, switched out a guy, and was once again tag team of the year. They managed to keep their momentum as a team and just seamlessly flow with, you know, what's the word I'm trying to say? You know, cohesiveness from one guy to a completely different guy. So I don't know, that for me is part of the astoundingness of the Midnight Express.
Yes, which is a big part also due to they're a three-man act. You know what I mean? Let's not downplay how great Cornette was in this whole thing. From when he's cutting the promos pre-match, doing their live introductions, to always being able to get the ref when he needs to. Like, I think that's also what helped the seamless transition was also that they had a really good manager that helped bring it all together too.
Yeah, part of me wanted to actually watch, like, the segments that led up because, you know, I saw the match. The first match they had is just the two of them. But I was like, oh, I bet the segments leading up were interesting.
Yeah, they probably were, just explaining, you know what I mean, especially when it's two teammates from other teams coming together.
Right. Yeah. Oh, okay. So I feel like I have a pretty decent answer for this next one, but I'll let you go. How would we defeat the Midnight Express?
I feel like it's a little go-to when we talk to teams of this era. We have to make it no DQ because there's so many DQ finishes, so we got to work that into ours, and we got to understand there's a third man on the outside. So, I mean, that's why I think it's almost got to be something a little Texas Tornado-type match where anything can go would be our best chance because that way we can try and combat Cornette or at least get rid of him as much as possible. And then, whew, as far as them, I think the only thing that would help us is we're way more modern than them. Like, you know what I mean? As far as like an arms race goes, I feel our double teams are way bigger than theirs. But theirs are a lot more devastating because they're much bigger men. So I think it kind of evens out there. And I don't know. Yeah, we might just have to outdo them with our modernness.
So I say, I don't think we need no DQ or tornado or whatever. I just think we keep them in the ring.
Oh, well, of course. Yeah, yeah. Well, they definitely like to throw you on the outside and let Corny get at you and stuff.
But they throw you on the outside, but they also, in the beginning, they never let the team really get up on them. They take one decently big move and they're gone. They're on the outside. They're recovering. They never let the team get momentum, you know? So I think if we just don't, like, I'm talking like hip toss, they hit the floor, we're diving. You know what I'm saying? Like, don't let them breathe. Don't let them, we can't play their game.
We can't let them strategize. That's one thing they were great at. They always took time to strategize and it always worked out. So we can't let them talk to each other. We got to smother them then.
Exactly. You can't let them catch their breath because that was their game. They were luring you into their game, which, you know, that's what I think. That's how I think we beat them. We smother them. You don't let them regroup. You don't let them strategize. You just keep the gas on.
Yeah, we would definitely have to game plan because, yeah, you know, you get emotional out there and, you know, you want to go after the dude with the racket. But no, we would have to. Yeah, we'd have to smother them and then just stay very firm into the game plan, like a UFC fight. It's like, all right, listen, no, we can't deviate from the game plan. All right, I'm with you.
Dude, the Rock and Roll Express would let the Midnight Express boogie every time they took a move. It was like, oh, there's a body slam and they're on the floor. And it's like, man, you got to stay on him, man. You got to keep a hand on that guy.
Yeah, no flexing for the crowd. We go right for him.
Yeah, rock and roll. Quit whamma-lamma-bamma-lamma-ing. Stay on the man.
Yeah, yeah. Stop putting your little peace hand signals and stuff. Go fight.
Exactly. So that's how we beat the Midnight Express. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is Sweet Stan Lane and Beautiful Bobby Eaton, The Midnight Express.
See, you were almost as good as Corey does. See, it's good.
Whew, that was a lot of fun. That was a lot of fun. There's a lot of things that I wrote in a separate notebook just to kind of remember and to take note of.
That, and I think I just want to go back and watch 1990 WCW again.
Well, come up with another team from that era that we can dive into, and we'll do it again soon.
Yep.
We can't back-to-back late 80s, early 90s WCW. We gotta switch it up here for next week.
Yeah, we got to go with something way different than this.
Yeah, I'm thinking about making a list of teams or writing team names on pieces of paper and filling a hat with tag team names so we don't have to ever think about it.
Ah, sometimes I like thinking about it. Sometimes it's a rough, but sometimes I like curating it, you know what I mean? Sometimes I like picking a nice week and being like, oh, no, this week we're going to dig into, you know what I mean? Sometimes I like being driven by whatever impulse. But if there's no impulse, okay, I'm not against the hat.
So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to make this hat. I'm going to fill a hat with names of tag teams. It's going to take me a long time. And then at the end of the episode, I'm going to be like, you want to think about a team or you want the hat?
Ooh, okay. That's fine.
And we'll go like this. Since I haven't done the hat yet, we'll have to use our brains this time. But I think we have a couple in our brains ready to go. So I think we should have one pretty quickly this time.
Yeah. We definitely got some ones that we've been holding off that we can get into.
But as always, follow us on Twitter at DreamWorkPod. And if you have a suggestion or something you would like to see or hear, then tweet it out. Tweet it at us. Hit us up. Or just hit us up and say hi. We're cool with that too.
Yeah, let us know you're listening. Let us know you're out there. And then, yeah, we'll hit you up and maybe we'll let you know what we're working on. You can give us what matches you think we should dig into.
Yeah. All right, guys. Until next week. See ya.
Adios.